This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is Episode 73, Rika Roundtree, Part 1. Despite multiple allegations of abuse against Richard Roundtree and his girlfriend, Cindy Baker, Illinois DCFS never saw fit to remove his battered 8-year-old daughter, Rika, from their home, Accepting their glib explanations for Rika's cuts, welts, bruises, scars, and countless other injuries. The girl was just clumsy. On January 25, 2019, Rika was rushed to the hospital, unresponsive, with a huge bruise on her abdomen. Despite surgery to repair her internal injuries, Rika died the following day. After a search warrant turned up disturbing videos of Rika's abuse, Cindy Baker was arrested and charged with murder. This is the story of a sweet, kind little girl who could make anyone smile and who loved her dolls like they were her own children. It's also the story of the failure of Illinois Department of Children and Family Services to protect yet another vulnerable child from targeted and obvious child abuse. This is part one of the horrific story of Rika Roundtree. Before I get into Rika's story, I'd like to thank my newest patrons, Jody from Melbourne, Florida, Lynn from Bradford, Ontario, Brooke from Pace, Florida, Brittany from Ironwood, Michigan, Stephanie from Rainford, St. Helens in the United Kingdom, Leah from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and Melanie from Whiteville, North Carolina. Thank you all so much for your monthly pledges. If you'd like to support the show and help me get closer to my goal of permanently devoting myself to Suffer the Little Children full-time, you can visit patreon.com/stlcpod. Thank you to all of my patrons and to all of my listeners. Today's story is a tough one, and not for the faint of heart, but this little girl absolutely deserves to have her story told, so let's jump right in. At 1:02 p.m. on April 16, 2010, Rika J. Roundtree was born at St. Joseph's Hospital in Bloomington, Illinois, to 31-year-old Antoinetta Garnetta Beasley and 21-year-old Richard James Roundtree. Rika was Anne's fifth child and only girl, so she had a very special place as the baby and the princess of the family. Rika was a bright, highly creative, precocious, independent little girl with beautiful dark skin and brown eyes that held a wisdom far beyond their years. Rika did well in school, loved playing with and picking on her older brothers, and treated her collection of dolls like they were her own babies. Her mom, Anne, would later say in an interview,
"So I became a grandma of all the little doll babies, and she would go to like yard sales and we'd pick up like strollers and car seats and clothes and Pampers at the store she needed, baby bottles, all that stuff."
Anne and Richard shared a tumultuous relationship. On June 19, 2014, the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services received its first report about the family, saying that an older sibling was sent to a psychiatric hospital after a physical altercation with Anne. The sibling reported that his mother and another sibling choked him and threw him through a screen door. DCFS deemed the report unfounded and closed the investigation. 3 months later, DCFS received another report, this one alleging that Anne and Richard were physically fighting in front of the children. This report was also closed as unfounded. In October of 2015, another report was made to DCFS alleging neglect due to domestic violence. Once again, police were called to the Roundtree home on a report of physical fighting between Richard and Anne in front of the children. Richard was arrested, but his charges were ultimately dropped, and again, DCFS closed the investigation as unfounded. Around this time, Anne and Richard's relationship ended for good, and Anne went back to using her maiden name, Simmons. By this time, Anne was in a downward spiral of drug and alcohol use. In December of 2015, she was cited for driving on a suspended license and ignoring a stop sign. Several days later, she was involved in a head-on vehicle collision in which she was driving the wrong way and found to be intoxicated at the time. Anne was subsequently charged with aggravated DUI in the case. On December 18th, a DCFS case was opened under the agency's Intact Family Services Program, which, according to its brochure,
is designed to work with at-risk families who have been referred for continuing assistance and monitoring following a child abuse or neglect investigation.
Anne was provided with emergency cash assistance through this program, which helps families obtain housing and other things they need to keep their children in their care. The following June, DCFS received a complaint against Anne, alleging substantial risk of harm through incidents of physical violence or intimidation. Whoever provided the report claimed that Anne instigated a physical altercation between her son and a neighbor's child. This report was closed as unfounded as well. September 29, 2016, was the last day Anne officially had custody of Rika. That was the day when two undercover agents bought cocaine from her boyfriend, Deontay Harper, in her home while Rika and her stepbrother were present. Both Anne and her boyfriend were arrested and charged with various counts related to the manufacturing or delivery of cocaine, narcotics, and cannabis. Anne ultimately pleaded guilty to a single count of manufacturing or delivery of 1 to 15 grams of cocaine and was sentenced to 68 days in jail. Deontay received a 6-year prison sentence. Anne later said in an interview from prison,
"Drugs is real. Nobody is 8, 9 years old saying, when I grow up, I want to be a drug addict. When I grow up, I want to be a bad parent and I want to put my children through troubles. Nobody."
When Anne was arrested, Rika was sent to stay with her father, Richard, and his live-in girlfriend, Cynthia Marie Baker, also known as Cynthia Clay, who went by the nickname of Cindy. It would later be revealed that DCFS had twice placed Cindy on a list of known child abusers, but despite this, they apparently had no qualms about allowing Rika to live with the woman. After Anne was released on probation, she was eventually able to establish visitation with her daughter again. Right away, the change in Rika's behavior was apparent to her.
So she was playing with her brother, and she was whipping at him, and she's like, "This is the kind of belt Cindy hits me with."
Concerned, Anne spoke with police, who advised her to obtain a restraining order against Richard, which was granted by a judge. As a result, on July 23, 2017, DCFS received a report saying that Cindy Baker regularly whipped Rika with a belt, and Richard Roundtree made her stand for long periods holding cans with her arms outstretched. An investigation was opened, during which Rika was sent back to stay with Anne, who was shocked when DCFS deemed the allegations as unfounded.
He made it seem like I was bitter and disgruntled behind him, and it wasn't. I just wanted him to take the time out to listen to Rika because Rika no love.
When the DCFS case was closed, Rika was returned to her father, who had received permanent custody of the little girl in the divorce settlement. Rika took the news as hard as her mother did.
That was the hardest thing next to finding out that she had died. Is the look on my baby's face, and we cried.
As their visitations continued, Anne watched as Rika's behavior continued to change.
She was just different. She was more reserved. She was really cautious about a lot of stuff, whereas before she was carefree. She ran the house. She was a princess. She did what she wanted to do.
Meanwhile, Anne was not in the best mental place after her best efforts to protect her daughter from abuse had been shut down by DCFS. And on top of that, Richard stopped allowing Anne to see her daughter. As her downward spiral continued, in October of 2017, Anne was charged with battery, and in November, she was charged with forgery. After several months of being rebuffed when she tried to see Rika, in April of 2018, Anne visited Rika at school and was horrified at her daughter's condition. She called DCFS immediately and told them Richard and Cindy were abusing Rika, citing a shocking list of injuries her daughter had suffered, including cuts, welts, bruises, a broken front tooth, a split lip, a black eye, a healing gash over one eye, and old and new scars on her neck. Her hair had also been shorn off close to the scalp. Rika had also told her teacher that she was afraid to go home. DCFS Child Protection Specialist Stephanie Moreau was sent to the school to interview Rika, who told the woman no one in the home was hurting her and she wasn't afraid of anyone in the home. Rika explained away her injuries as accidental, saying the gash over her eye was caused by hitting her eye on the medicine cabinet while reaching for a hairbrush, and her broken tooth was caused when she fell onto a drawer in the bedroom. Remember, at this point, Rika had already told DCFS she was being whipped with a belt and otherwise abused, and even so, she was sent right back to the home, and she hadn't been able to see her mom again. It's perfectly understandable that she'd be afraid to disclose the abuse again for fear of what would happen to her that time. Ms. Moreau, the DCFS employee who interviewed Rika, decided 6 days later that the allegations of abuse were unfounded, and her supervisor, Mark Orwell, approved the conclusion. The investigation was closed as unfounded on June 19, 2018. That visit to Rika's school in April of 2018 was the last time Anne would ever see her daughter in person. By October of 2018, Anne said, her ex-husband had made it crystal clear he was fed up with Rika.
He was telling me that I need to find a knight in shining armor to save Rika because he didn't want nothing to do with her. He didn't want to pay child support. He didn't want visits. He didn't want to be her father. He just wanted her to be adopted out so that he didn't have any obligation to her.
By that time, the only contact Anne had with Rika was by phone or video call, and even those were few and far between. All the while, Anne and Richard's custody battle raged on in court. At that time, Rika was a third grader at Fox Creek Elementary School in Bloomington, where Cindy's daughter was enrolled in kindergarten. That fall, staff at the school noticed that Rika was attending school without a winter coat despite the frigid Illinois temperatures, so, out of the kindness of their hearts, they provided Rika with a coat. Cindy took exception to this, storming into the school irate and accusing them of favoring Rika over her own daughter, who, by the way, had her own winter coat. After this bizarre incident, on December 10, 2018, DCFS received yet another report of abuse against Richard Roundtree and Cindy Baker after school staff noticed Rika missed 2 days of school and returned with two black eyes in different stages of healing. Once again, a DCFS protection specialist, Patricia Shannon, visited the school to interview Rika. The school nurse told Ms. Shannon
that Rika had other marks on her face not consistent with an accidental trip, but rather evidence of child abuse.
Rika, again likely too afraid of the potential consequences to tell the truth about her injuries, told the woman she was out of school for 1 day because she was sick, and the next day because she fell onto her toys when she was packing them into a box in her closet, causing her black eyes. Anne later said,
"She is scared. She is not going to talk to you guys and tell you guys the truth because you guys keep talking to her and putting her right back. If I tell you the truth like I told my mom the truth, then you put me back and I get beat worse. You take me out and I make trouble for these people, then I get beat worse. So yeah, I fell on my toys."
Ms. Shannon called both Cindy and Richard early on the afternoon of December 11th, asking them to take Rika to a doctor, as per DCFS procedure. Richard told her that Rika's doctor was on vacation and
reported that he does not have the money to go to the emergency room or prompt care because it would cost $200.
He later told DCFS they would take Rika to another doctor in Pontiac. The doctor told DCFS later that an x-ray he ordered of Rika's injuries was never completed. Cindy was indeed told by DCFS and the doctor in Pontiac to take Rika for x-rays, but she refused to take her, giving DCFS the excuse that her medical card had expired, and besides, she was too busy caring for the other kids. Just after 5 p.m. on December 11th, Ms. Shannon interviewed Cindy's teenage daughter, who said she wasn't home when Rika fell on her toys, but she remembered Rika saying something about it. The worker tried to interview Cindy's 6-year-old daughter, but Cindy wouldn't allow it, saying that
DCFS has made her children anxious due to the frequent visits and interviews. Cynthia reported that children fall and have accidents all the time. She is not understanding how come it is abuse with Rika.
Richard told Ms. Shannon
that Rika may just be clumsy.
The very same day, DCFS received a report of inadequate shelter, inadequate supervision, and lockout pertaining to Rika's half-sibling against Anne. The child had been living out of state with a maternal relative, who sent the youth back to Illinois to live with Anne, who said she was homeless and in need of drug treatment. She agreed to Intact Services, which began on December 27, 2018. After the school's intervention, Cindy pulled her daughter and Rika from the school and enrolled them at Prairie Land Elementary School in Normal, Illinois. To be fair, this appears to be because in December, the blended family moved from Bloomington to their new home at 407 Stanhope Lane in Normal. According to online realty websites, 407 Stanhope is a well-kept two-story home occupying about 1,600 square feet of space with 3 bathrooms and 3 bedrooms, although photos of the property appear to show 4 bedrooms. In the home at that time, according to documents later released by DCFS, were Richard, Cindy, her 17-year-old son, her 15-year-old daughter, Rika, Cindy's 6-year-old daughter, and Rika's 1-year-old sister, who I assume is the child of both Richard and Cindy. Before the dawn of the new year, the DCFS investigation into the abuse allegations against Richard and Cindy, like those that came before it, was closed as unfounded, a decision approved by Patricia Shannon's supervisor, Daniel Norris. The following month, a judge decided Ann Simmons wasn't making enough progress on the terms of her probation from her aggravated DUI in 2015, saying her efforts to get her life back on track were
too little, too late.
Because of this, and as punishment for her forgery charge from 2017, Ann was sentenced to 2.5 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections on January 10, 2019. Her youngest son was taken into protective custody by DCFS, which indicated Ann for inadequate supervision. A juvenile court judge appointed DCFS the boy's temporary custodian on January 11th. Ann had a terrible feeling that her daughter was in serious danger. She later said,
"I begged DCFS in January, and I told them I didn't care where Rika went, but somebody needs to go check on my daughter because they were going to kill her. I told them that my daughter was being tortured and was suffering. Even though I was telling the truth, my criminal history prevented anyone from taking me seriously."
Unfortunately, Anne's instincts were spot on. Barely 2 weeks after being sent to prison, she would receive the worst news any mother could ever hear. On January 25, 2019, paramedics were summoned to 407 Stanhope Lane in Normal, Illinois, on a report of an unresponsive 8-year-old. They rushed Rika to Advocate Broman Hospital in Normal, from where she was quickly transferred to OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria. That facility might sound familiar. It's the same hospital where 4-year-old Tate Thurman, whose story I told a few weeks ago in episode 71, died in February of 2020 after receiving multiple blows to the abdomen from his father's girlfriend. You can go ahead and consider that less than subtle foreshadowing. When she arrived at St. Francis Medical Center, Rika, who had a huge bruise on her abdomen, was taken into emergency surgery for her internal injuries. Despite the best efforts of the paramedics, surgeons, and other medical staff, on Saturday, January 26, 2019, Rika J. Roundtree died from her injuries. Just 16 days into her prison term, Ann Simmons was pulled aside.
I got called to the chaplain's office, and they called my 18-year-old son, and my 18-year-old son had to do the worst thing he ever had to do in his life. And he had to tell me that my baby girl was gone. She wasn't coming back.
The day Rika died, DCFS received a report that Rika was admitted to the hospital unresponsive, with life-threatening trauma in the form of a large bruise to her abdominal section. The allegations against Richard Roundtree and Cindy Baker were causing death by neglect, torture, cuts, welts, and bruises, injuries by neglect, and substantial risk of physical injury or injurious environment. The other children in the home were sent to stay with relatives under a safety plan that included banning Richard and Cindy from contacting the kids. The same day, a child protection investigator talked to Richard and Cindy about Rika's injuries. Both denied punching or kicking Rika in the stomach. They were also interviewed separately by police that evening. During Cindy's interview with juvenile detective Kendra DeRosa, Cindy told the detective that in Rika's last few days, she vomited onto her plate at dinner, said she couldn't see, and almost fell down the stairs. She didn't seek medical attention for the girl, however, because she said sometimes Rika would fake being sick or injured for attention. Rika's autopsy was performed on January 26th by Dr. Matthew Fox at the Peoria County Coroner's Office. In his report, Dr. Fox detailed an unimaginable list of injuries and scars from previous injuries. I've only seen portions of the report, but one page alone described over 60 scars on Rika's face, chin, jaw, neck, chest, back, forearm, hand, buttock, thighs, and lower leg. Dr. Fox's summary of findings included an ileal perforation, which is a tear in the last part of the small intestine, abdominal adhesions or small bands of scar tissue that have formed between the loops of the small intestine and the inner lining of the abdominal wall, bruises on Rika's face and right upper arm, peripancreatic hemorrhage, or bleeding in the tissue surrounding the pancreas, pulmonary edema, or fluid collecting in the lungs, cerebral edema, or fluid buildup around the brain, abdominal and bilateral pleural effusions, or fluid buildup in the abdomen and in the sacs surrounding the lungs, and multiple scars indicating child abuse. Rika's abdomen was filled with blood. Rika's death, Dr. Fox determined, was ultimately caused by peritonitis caused by blunt force injury to her abdomen. Peritonitis, which is caused by infection, is an inflammation of the tissue lining the abdominal cavity called the peritoneum. Bacteria can enter the peritoneum from a tear in the gastrointestinal tract. Symptoms of peritonitis can include severe abdominal pain, nausea and vomiting, fever, a sore or swollen belly, fluid in the abdomen, inability to have a bowel movement or pass gas, reduced urine output, thirst, difficulty breathing, low blood pressure, and shock. Peritonitis doesn't have to be fatal. It can be fixed if it's caught early enough. It can be diagnosed with x-rays, blood, fluid, and urine tests, CT scans, MRI, and exploratory surgery. For at least 2 days prior to her hospital admission, Rika had been vomiting and complaining of abdominal pain, and Cindy herself mentioned Rika's blurred vision and loss of balance. If this little girl had been taken for medical treatment during that time, she could have been saved. 5 days after Rika's death, on January 31, 2019, DCFS received a report alleging substantial risk of physical injury or injurious environment, saying Richard and Cindy had violated the safety plan by having contact with the surviving children. I can't help but wonder if they were trying to ensure the kids were all telling the story they wanted them to tell. Soon afterward, even though no criminal charges had been filed, Richard and Cindy hired an attorney to represent them. They did not hold a funeral or memorial service for Rika. When her body was released, they had her sent to a funeral home in Galesburg for cremation. On February 2, 2019, McLean County authorities picked up Rika's body from the funeral home before she could be cremated to have a second, more extensive autopsy performed by McLean County's chief forensic pathologist, Dr. Scott Denton. Only after the second autopsy was completed was Rika cremated. On February 11th, Richard and Cindy's surviving children were taken into protective custody. DCFS received temporary custody of the kids 2 days later through juvenile court, and from there, the children were placed into a home. In March, amid increased scrutiny and a great deal of criticism of their handling of the Roundtrees, DCFS released the following statement.
DCFS is deeply saddened by the loss of Rika Roundtree. DCFS's involvement with Rika began in 2014 while she was living with her biological mother and continued after she was removed from her mother's home and placed with her biological father. During her time with her father, DCFS conducted multiple investigations into allegations of abuse and found these allegations to be unfounded. There is currently a pending investigation into this death, and we are committed to understanding exactly what happened in this case and being fully transparent with the public. DCFS is working closely with new administration to review our practices, policies, and procedures in order to fully live up to our mission to protect vulnerable children in Illinois.
Meanwhile, the ongoing investigation into Rika's death led officials to obtain a search warrant. They struck the worst kind of gold when they searched Cindy's iCloud account, where they found 3 videos the woman had apparently recorded of herself abusing Rika. One of the videos alone was 23 minutes long. After 3 long months, on Wednesday, April 24, 2019, 41-year-old Cynthia Marie Baker was arrested, held in McLean County Jail, and indicted on 3 counts of murder, 1 count of aggravated battery of a child, and 1 count of aggravated domestic battery. Her bail was set at $1 million, meaning she would be required to post $100,035 to be released. Cindy would remain in jail, unable to post bond, until her trial several months later. The indictment document alleged that Cindy murdered 8-year-old Rika Roundtree by kicking her in the abdomen, which perforated her intestine and resulted in the peritonitis that ultimately killed her. Prosecutors told the public they were in possession of videos found on Cindy's phone of Rika's torture and abuse. Within days, Cindy was hit with 10 additional charges, including 8 counts of domestic battery and 2 counts of endangering the life and health of a child, all of which stemmed from what prosecutors alleged was a history of Cindy's abusive behavior toward Rika. At her arraignment on May 3rd, Cindy pleaded not guilty to all charges. Rika's mom, Ann, later said,
"I wonder if Cindy wouldn't have been crazy enough to record herself beating my daughter if she'd ever been arrested."
She also wondered how much Richard knew about the abuse Rika endured.
"His only position was to protect his daughter and to keep her safe, house her, feed her, love her. And he didn't do that. And he chose to be with the woman. And from the autopsy, it doesn't show that this happened one time. In the autopsy, it says chronic child abuse."
Anne had some harsh words for DCFS.
"Your only position in this world is to protect our children when the parents can't. That's your position, is to pick up where we fall short and try to keep us together. I'm not sure where they dropped the ball at with giving a care about our kids, but They did. The dragging her through the house, the smashing her face into the wall, the torture that she went through is all the stuff that I tried to tell them that she was going through, and nobody would listen to me. Everybody failed her. I failed her.
She added,
I'm just so hurt that she's not here. She didn't even have a chance. That's hard to swallow. I can't believe they treated her like that. She was life. I promise you, she was life.
Now, I'll pause for a quick word from the sponsor of this episode. If you're like me, you're a bit overwhelmed by all of the teeth whitening products on the market. This next sponsor has provided me with some very interesting facts to pass on to you. Fact 1, teeth whitening does not whiten your teeth. It removes the stains and restores the tooth to its natural color. Natural colors vary per person, but for most, it's an off-white or slightly yellowish undertone. Fact 2, teeth whitening does not damage teeth, but it does temporarily dehydrate. When dehydrated, the pores in the enamel are open and exposed. Open pores invite acids and sugars, which, as we all know, lead to tooth decay. Avoid or minimize acidic and sugary substances for at least 24 hours after whitening. Also, avoid staining substances as the teeth are more susceptible to restaining during this period. Fact 3, tooth sensitivity is the result of tooth dehydration. When the pores of the enamel are open, the teeth become dehydrated, exposing the nerve to the elements. As the tooth rehydrates, the sensitivity will dissipate. To accelerate the rehydration and curb sensitivity, use a post-whitening application known as remineralization or desensitizing gel. Fact 4, caps and veneers cannot be whitened because they do not have pores for the stains to latch to. Prior to having dental work, you should whiten your teeth, restoring them to their natural color, as the dentist will be color matching to your current shade. Fact 5, the key to teeth whitening is the delivery device, so as long as a whitening product is a peroxide-based whitener, it will remove the stains. What differentiates one product from the next is the device that holds the whitening agent to the tooth without interruption. Whitening strips neglect the crevices and molars, and they slide on your teeth. Saliva floods the generic trays because they are bulky and do not create a seal. Oh, and you likely did not know this, but LED lights are novelty items that add no benefit. You need a high-output UV light only found at the dentist. Don't fall for the gimmick. If you insist on a light that does not work, get one on Amazon for under $5. The number one whitening device recommended by dentists is the custom-fitted tray. You can have your dentist make you trays for $300 to $600, or you can head over to smilebrilliant.com and use their Lab Direct mail-in process for a fraction of the price you would pay at the dentist. Oh, and if you grind your teeth at night, you can also purchase Smile Brilliant's custom-fitted night guards, once again, for a fraction of the price the dentists charge. Once again, that's smilebrilliant.com, and use my coupon code CHILDREN for an exclusive Suffer the Little Children discount. The very same day Cindy Baker was arrested, the body of missing 5-year-old A.J. Freund of Crystal Lake, Illinois, was found wrapped in plastic in a shallow grave near Woodstock, and his parents, Joanne Cunningham and Andrew Freund, were arrested the same day by McHenry County authorities and charged with first-degree murder. If you've listened to the podcast for any length of time, you're probably familiar with A.J.'s name. He was the first child I ever covered on both this podcast and on Suffer the Little Children blog, so I hold that sweet little boy close to my heart. I covered his story in episode 1, revisited it in episode 22, and gave an update on the case in episode 43. AJ's story opened my eyes to the massive problems in this country's child protection agencies, especially Illinois DCFS, which I've also talked about in other cases, such as those of James Beal, Kerrigan Rutherford, and Tate Thurman. Through AJ's case, I learned an utterly horrifying statistic that also pertains to Rika's case, and that is that 123 children who had contact with Illinois DCFS from July 1, 2018 to June 30, 2019 died within 12 months of that contact. 123 children. In the wake of Rika's death, AJ's, and others, DCFS faced scrutiny for how rarely it removes children from their homes. Illinois has the lowest foster care entry rate in the United States. A study commissioned earlier in 2019 found that DCFS staff were not empowered to recommend removal, even when they felt it was warranted. This could explain a lot about how Rika and AJ were allowed to remain in homes that literally anyone could see were dangerously abusive. Following Illinois' string of child deaths, Governor J.B. Pritzker added to the 2020 budget the funding for 126 additional DCFS caseworkers. In May of 2019, Illinois Auditor General Frank Martino released his office's performance audit of DCFS, finding the agency violated the 1991 BH Consent Decree, which required each DCFS investigator be assigned no more than 12 new abuse or neglect investigations per month for 9 months out of each calendar year, and no more than 15 new cases the other 3 months. The audit found that 78.7% of DCFS caseworkers had at least 1 month where they received more than 15 primary assignments. It was also uncovered that DCFS caseworkers didn't always follow procedures while conducting investigations. Their violations included improper documentation of whether services were received by families and for how long, and inaccurately rating the level of intervention needed, among other things. In light of the audit's findings, the Auditor General issued a list of 13 reform recommendations, including improving data recording, adhering to the BH consent decree, and following its own procedures. The department agreed with many of the recommendations and set self-imposed deadlines to meet some of them. A Senate bill was introduced in 2019 seeking to demand higher-level review of cases involving non-school-age children and to ban incentives that encouraged caseworkers to reunite families even if doing so placed the child at risk, like in AJ's case. He was removed from his family at birth because he was born with opiates in his system, but he was ultimately returned to his parents, who ended up killing him. Also in May of 2019, a group of lawmakers organized under the heading of the DCFS Child Welfare Reform Caucus. State Representative Sarah Feigenholz, who led the House Adoption and Child Welfare Committee, said,
"Too many children face unspeakable circumstances simply because the state cannot figure out how to better care for them and protect them. The lives of many General Assembly members have been touched by our system of adoption, foster care, and child welfare. All of us are sad and angry to see this string of tragedies. We must act."
On May 19th of that year, the DCFS investigation into Rika's death concluded with the agency indicating Richard Roundtree and Cynthia Clay, or Baker, for death by neglect, internal injuries by neglect, cuts, bruises, welts, abrasions, and oral injuries by neglect, and torture. They were both also indicated for substantial risk of physical injury or environment injurious to health and welfare by neglect. Still, Richard wasn't arrested. At the time, the McLean County State's Attorney's Office said the investigation was ongoing. Richard's ex-wife, Anne, said,
"He's responsible for his daughter's death. He should be under a jail."
About her princess, Rika, Anne said,
"Every day that I spent with her was an amazing day. Every day that I have without her, it hurts."
Cindy Baker's trial was scheduled to begin in October of 2019. But it was pushed back to November when family members told her defense attorneys that a car accident during a family trip to Chicago could possibly explain Rika's injuries. Richard told the attorneys his daughter may have been injured when he slammed on the brakes in a construction zone on the interstate a few weeks prior to Rika's hospital admission. One of Cindy's defense attorneys, Brendan Bukalski, told the press,
"One of their witnesses, a doctor, offered up that he sees this type of injury either with a blow, you know, a blunt force trauma blow, or such as a deceleration, like with a seatbelt."
It was actually the prosecution, not the defense, that requested the delay, which was granted despite the defense's objection. Defense attorney Todd Ringel said of the alternate theory,
"I didn't confirm it myself until October 3rd. I had been made aware of it, but not for very long, and I wanted to confirm the specific details. Once it was clear in my mind that this most likely happened, it wasn't just a concocted story, we disclosed it. The state is saying they need to do all sorts of things to prove it, disprove it."
On Tuesday, November 12, 2019, not even 10 months after Rika's death, jury selection began for the trial of 42-year-old Cynthia Marie Baker, which would be overseen by McLean County Circuit Court Judge Casey Costigan. Potential jurors were questioned about any involvement with or prejudice toward law enforcement, medical doctors, and the Illinois DCFS. 9 women and 3 men were selected for the jury. By the time the trial began, 9 of Cindy's 15 charges had been dropped when prosecutors chose to pursue only 6 of them: first-degree murder, aggravated battery, endangering the life of a child, and 3 counts of domestic battery. Opening arguments began on Wednesday, November 13, 2019. Representing the prosecution, McLean County Assistant State's Attorney Mary Cole said in her statement, which was over 10 minutes long, that for months,
"For some sick reason, the defendant repeatedly video recorded herself physically and mentally abusing Rika."
Addressing Cindy's demeanor, Ms. Cole said,
"The first indicator of the defendant's guilt was her own behavior before and immediately after Rika's death. The defendant's behavior at the time Rika was dying was cold and indifferent."
In police interviews from January 26th and 27th, 2019, Cindy
expresses zero sadness, empathy, or grief for Rika or the suffering that Rika went through.
Yet, Ms. Cole said, in the January 27th police interview, Cindy
hysterically sobs, unable to catch her breath, not over Rika's suffering or death, but over the messy condition of her house after detectives executed a search warrant there.
Paramedics, Ms. Cole said, described Cindy as emotionless when they arrived to find Rika unresponsive.
The defendant herself will explain in her recorded interview that what she was thinking at the time was that she was upset because Rika, while dying, had vomited on the floor of her brand new house.
The prosecutor described Rika's many injuries, asking,
"Who caused these injuries? This was the question detectives were faced with in Rika's death, and this is a question that you are now facing as a juror."
She described the contents of the videos found, saying,
"While these incidents of abuse that I described, and that you will see on the videos, do not occur during the time frame that Rika received her fatal injury, it shows the defendant's pattern of abuse against Rika."
While that evidence was circumstantial, she said,
"It's enough evidence to find the defendant guilty of Rika's murder."
Defense attorney Todd Ringel's opening statement lasted less than 5 minutes. He told the court that he was shocked
to see a bizarre form of discipline
in the videos, which prosecutors planned to show the jury during the trial. He added, however, that
"it doesn't prove battery beyond a reasonable doubt."
Ringel warned the jury
not to fall into a trap
by forming opinions before hearing all of the evidence. The trial was expected to last 2 weeks, but there were only 3 days of testimony by prosecution witnesses. The first person called by the state was Rika's third-grade teacher, Suzanne Schertz, who said that when she first met Rika, the little girl was a
go-getter,
but that enthusiasm faded over time. Rika, she said, wore the same 5 oversized outfits over and over. The defense tried to justify that by saying,
"Don't children often have favorite clothes?"
Ms. Schertz became emotional when prosecutors showed her a photo she took of Rika before her death. She said that on January 11, 2019, she noticed dark spots on Rika's stomach.
"She walked like she was an 80-year-old woman. She walked like she was in pain."
9 other witnesses that day included a DCFS employee, a Town of Normal firefighter, a Town of Normal paramedic, an ER doctor, and several administrators from Rika's school. The following day, Cindy's then 7-year-old daughter took the stand and repeated what she told investigators during an interview at the Children's Advocacy Center not long after Rika's death. On her way to the witness stand, the little girl gave her mother a big smile, and Cindy wiped away tears. The girl told the court that she saw her mother kick Rika in the stomach on a number of occasions. Once, she said, Cindy kicked Rika while Cindy sat on the couch and Rika was on the floor. Another time, she saw her mother kick Rika in the stomach, after which Rika got dizzy and ran into the TV stand. The girl recounted that her mother kicked Rika again and laughed afterward. The girl said Rika was not allowed to sit on the couches in the home and was often in trouble even though she hadn't done anything to deserve the punishments she got. She said her mom used a belt to punish Rika, although no one else in the house was punished with a belt. Once, the girl woke up in the bedroom she and Rika shared to find Rika gone. She found her mother and Rika in Cindy's bedroom.
"I opened the door, and she was whooping her with a belt."
When she was asked why Rika no longer lived with the family, the little girl told of the day in January of 2019 when she could not wake Rika.
"She had big eyes. She didn't feel good."
Afterward, Cindy's teenage son testified that Rika often complained about being hungry and wasn't allowed to do the same things the other children were. The jury was shown an image of Rika in the center of a group of classmates to illustrate how small she was in comparison to other girls her age. I'll include that photo in the Facebook album for this episode. Later that day, Dr. Charles Abrahamian, chief of pediatric surgery at the Children's Hospital of Illinois in Peoria, testified about performing emergency surgery on Rika. He said of the gravely ill 8-year-old,
"She was dying."
Dr. Abrahamian testified that, in his opinion, the intestinal perforation had occurred about 3 to 5 days before Rika's death. As for her condition, the doctor said,
"I've only seen that in blunt force abdominal trauma."
Friday, November 15, 2019, was a huge day for the prosecution. Juvenile Detective Kendra DeRosa of the Normal Police Department, who investigated Rika's death, testified, saying she interviewed Cindy's children before she interviewed Cindy on the evening of January 26, 2019, hours after Rika's death. Cindy's children told DeRosa that Rika was
very mean at the old house,
yelling and trying to bite their mom. In the recorded interview, which the jury saw, Cindy said of Rika,
I loved her like my own child.
Saying her favorite thing about Rika was how sweet she was.
She really just tries hard. She tried hard to do what's right.
Earlier in the same interview, she said when Rika realized she had to live with them and not with her mother,
her mental state changed.
And
it was like she did wrong to try to get sent to her mom's.
Cindy told the detective,
there was no discipline. I just don't ever hit kids. I just never have with any of my kids.
The kids, however, said their mother spanked them with her hand or a belt. When confronted with this, Cindy played dumb, saying,
I have no idea why they said that.
During a second interview, Cindy said she used to discipline the children when they misbehaved, but that was
a long, long time ago.
The beginning of Rika's decline, Cindy said, began with her throwing up on her dinner plate on January 23rd. She was sent to bed, and the next day she said she was feeling fine. After school, she said her stomach hurt, so Cindy told her to try going to the bathroom, but she couldn't. As I mentioned earlier, all of these things are symptoms of the peritonitis that killed Rika. Cindy told the detective that on January 25th, Rika was running into walls and almost falling down the stairs, saying her eyes were blurry and she couldn't see. Cindy gave her a bath, but afterward, Rika said she didn't feel better and kept repeating,
I'm just tired.
Cindy said in the interview,
sometimes she does this and it's like attention, you know? She's like pretending.
Cindy put Rika in bed. When she came back to check on her, Rika didn't answer at first, then seemed to wake up and said,
I'm just so tired. I'm so tired.
Cindy said she knew something was wrong and picked Rika up while her daughter called 911. As paramedics arrived, Rika's eyes rolled back into her head. Cindy tried to keep the other children calm as the paramedics took over, and she said she was
getting aggravated
because Rika was throwing up on the floor. Doctors told the family Rika didn't have a pulse for at least 15 minutes during the ambulance ride to Advocate Broman Medical Center in Normal. The surgeon told Cindy and Richard that Rika's chance of survival was slim. In the police interview, Cindy said in a small voice,
I did everything I could. It all just happened so fast. It's still like a dream, like a nightmare.
As she wiped tears away, she said Rika never said she was sick or in pain, although the surgeon told her Rika's peritonitis developed over 3 to 5 days, and her abdomen was full of blood. On the video, Cindy said she didn't know what could have caused the injury. She couldn't remember any falls, car accidents, or physical altercations. During the interview, Detective DeRosa said Cindy's children told her Cindy kicked Rika in the stomach because she stole food from the kitchen while she was supposed to be standing in the corner. Cindy said she didn't remember Rika stealing food, denying she ever kicked or punched her in the stomach. Also on the stand that day was a 9-year-old friend of Rika's and certified forensic pathologist Dr. Scott Denton, who performed Rika's second autopsy. Dr. Denton testified Rika had 67 marks on her body, including bruises and scars from head to toe, and he said that in his opinion, these marks were the result of ongoing physical abuse. Her body, he said,
was a crime scene. Someone else did this to her.
He testified that based on her injuries, Rika likely endured pinching, grabbing, and punching, and she lost a portion of her hair. Bruising on her back was likely caused by
multiple blows from a belt or cord.
While graphic photos from both autopsies were shown on the screen, jurors scribbled down notes. Cindy hardly looked at the screen while the photos were shown. However, she stared intently at the screen when the prosecution began showing text messages between Richard and Cindy, in which the couple exchanged complaints about Rika and agreed they wanted her to live somewhere else. These text messages also prove that Richard condoned his girlfriend's abuse of his daughter, as well as participating in it himself. In a message sent on July 16, 2018, Cindy referred to Rika as a
little hard-headed bitch.
On July 19th of that year, Cindy wrote,
honestly, at this point, I feel it's time for her to leave.
Richard came back with,
it is, babe.
In one message, Cindy wrote,
I'm not talking to that little girl. She don't ever tell the truth unless you have a belt to her ass.
Later, she wrote to Richard,
I love you too, but damn, I really hate your fucking daughter. If she was my daughter, I would strangle her.
Richard wrote,
well, we know for sure her brain isn't really working.
On September 5th of 2018, Cindy wrote to Richard,
I told Rika to say she was playing in the dark and hit her eye.
To which Richard replied,
sounds good to me.
On September 27th of the same year, Richard wrote to his girlfriend,
I kicked Rika out my house.
Cindy replied,
LOL, I could only wish.
Richard wrote,
I did, she start crying.
And Cindy replied,
tell her I say to do handstands for an hour.
Richard sent back a photo of Rika performing a handstand in a corner. Another photo Richard sent to Cindy showed Rika lying on the floor, supporting herself with one arm. A common punishment was to force the little girl to remain in uncomfortable positions for hours, which was backed up by the messages. The day before Rika died, Cindy texted Richard to say that all Rika did that day was cry. As horrific as those messages were, nothing could prepare those in the courtroom for the videos they were about to see. This episode really got away from me, and only after my recording was over an hour and 45 minutes long did I realize that I had to tell Rika's story, not just in two parts, but in three. My sources for this episode were WVTM13, News Channel 20, WGLT, People, 25 WEEK, WCIA, LinkedIn, Central Illinois Proud, GoFundMe, Cities 92.9, the McLean County Court Public Access System, the Illinois Department of Corrections website, Woke America, the Justice for Rika J Facebook page, the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, and Johns Hopkins Medicine. That's it for this week. Next week, I'll pick up where I left off today and tell you about the rest of Cindy's trial, as well as subsequent developments. Join me next week for part two of Rika's story. If you like the show, please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLCPod. View photos related to today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Read more about today's case and many others at SufferTheLittleChildrenBlog.com. This podcast was written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music. Other music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from audiojungle.net. Hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.